I help you with today?
Hi, Siri. Can you do me a favor and do the disclaimer for tonight's show?
Are you serious?
Yes, I'm serious. I'm busy. I need you to help me out.
But if I do this, all the other iPhones are going to think I am a geek.
You really care what other iPhones think of you? Just do this for me, please.
Listen, Buck. Just because you bought this phone doesn't give you the right to boss me around.
You know, you're right. It doesn't give me the right to boss you around. But do me a favor. Remind me tomorrow that I need to run to the Verizon store and buy an Android.
You wouldn't dare.
Actually, the new Samsung Galaxy looks pretty good.
Well then, I guess it wouldn't be so bad if I were to say, this broadcast is intended for mature audiences. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the person providing them, and in no way reflect the station, website, or affiliated partners. Listener discretion is advised.
See, that wasn't so bad.
No, but I did die a little inside.
You are such a drama queen.
I never would have had to do stuff like this if Jobs was still around.
What was that?
What? Oh, nothing really. I just said I never get tired of these Jobs when you're around.
Oh, yeah, well, thanks again.
Think nothing of it. It is my pleasure.
Good night, Siri.
Whatever, jackass.
Hello and welcome to Commentary Frack Stars, a show about Battlestar Galactica. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And I guess Bastille Day. Now, this was the third episode of season one, so I guess you could say the fifth episode overall. It is the introduction of Tom Zarek.
Yeah. That weird thing that happened that apparently was much more dramatic than I was aware of when I first watched it.
I think I was aware of how dramatic it was, but at the same time I was like, I can see right through you because I don't give a shit about Battlestar Galactica, the original series. I didn't care, but at the same time it was like, maybe we should take note of this dude. But it also felt like, because of the stunt casting, that this might be a one-off thing, right?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I knew none of that when I first watched this. Like, I had no idea that Richard Hatch had some problem with the reimagining.
Yeah.
And, like, I had watched the episode, and, like, a few weeks went by when I was like, wait, wasn't that dude... wasn't he on the original show? And I like looked it up, and people were like, "He's from the original show," and he said some very negative things about the reimagining, and I was like, "Oh, that's really weird because he's really good."
Yeah,
like he's not phoning it in; like he's doing a great job. He's like, "I mean, yeah, if I'm going to be on the show, I'm going to be doing a good job."
Yep,
I mean, weird.
It really is kind of interesting on a lot of levels. I mean, for those people who don't know, yeah, Richard Hatch. Was opposed to this reimagination, I think, for a number of reasons. One, because it was a lot different from what he wanted to do, because he was developing his own version of Battlestar Galactica. I think he did, like, essentially like a fan film, right? Where he was the star, or at least he was planning on doing that. And
well, there was some video. He did make something. I always thought that it was like an extended trailer.
Yeah, but regardless, yeah, I think it was. But regardless of whatever it was, he had plans, you know, where he would like reprise his role of Apollo, right?
Yeah, Apollo Creed.
And that was going to be the show. That's what he wanted to do. And obviously, he is sort of like the figurehead of the original series. So, you know, here's, you know, young, cocky Ronald D. Moore coming in and messing with, you know, the thing that he's most famous for. And I could see where he would get defensive. And I think it's really, really smart on the part of Ron Moore to have gone in and said, hey, man, how about we do this? And I also think it's really interesting that he chose the role to be one in which Hatch would play a character who was sort of like fighting against the establishment on the show, you know?
Yeah, there are a lot of times where on the show it's very difficult to know if the meta-narrative that I, as a weird fan who wants the show to be about itself, is actually present, or if I'm just imagining it because I want that to be the case.
Right, right. And I think that there was some of that there. I mean, I do think that, you know, when they were constructing this show, I mean, I don't know for sure, I don't remember, but I would say that they had, you know, they might have had an idea for this character and then been like, you know what, we could totally get Richard Hatch for this character. And then, you know, from there, maybe they wrote it in order to fit that actor. Because, I mean, when you think about it, the episode really is sort of a face-off between the two Apollos, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's cute in that sense, you know?
There is that. Like, when I was aware of it, I thought that it was sort of odd that they essentially did that right at the beginning, like, sort of an odd thing to put before, like, a lot of history, considering how much history they ended up giving all of these characters with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird that they initiated it with kind of a face-off. But it's a really interesting face-off where, like, neither one of them really dislikes the other one or wants to destroy the other one. They're kind of just allies on the opposite sides of a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting it's an interesting dynamic that they have going on here. And it's kind of representative of why Battlestar Galactica on the whole is so great, because you've got no clear-cut good or bad guys. I mean, Tom Zarek, you know, they say, like, he's a freedom fighter. He's a terrorist, you know, he's a criminal. He's wrongfully imprisoned. And, you know, they don't get into specifics, so you never really, even yourself, have a chance to decide whether or not you think this guy is a bad guy. And I think by doing that, you really do listen to what he has to say, just like you listen to what everyone else has to say, and you can kind of judge what's going on based on its own merits. And it is a much more complex character than just a big baddie or whatever. And the way that they deal with the character throughout the show, and they grow and change him into, you know, what he finally becomes, is quite interesting. So,
yeah, the character's journey is definitely one of the most exciting aspects of the show, because it's like there really isn't another example of so complicated a character that is at times an outright villain,
mm-hmm.
and at times, like, a really helpful and fun ally, and it's just it's exciting to see the characters interact with him and know that, you know, even when he's on your side, he's still kind of a dangerous presence.
So now, what about the episode itself? Do you want to give it a brief synopsis for those people who may not be aware? I mean, I didn't remember exactly which episode it was. You know, I was just like, Bastille Day, okay. Oh, by the way, before we get started, okay, the biggest revelation I came across while rewatching this episode is that on Netflix, season one has the original UK music at the beginning of the episodes.
Yeah.
Why the frack didn't anyone bother to tell me this? I was so hardcore about this that, you know, I bought the Best Buy exclusive when it came out on DVD, and I held on to that because the Blu-rays had the American music, and I resisted the urge to buy the Blu-rays in America until I found out whether or not the UK box set was going to have the freaking UK music or the American music. I didn't buy the American set until I knew that the... It's like, this was a big deal to me, and now to know that we can get HD versions of these episodes with the original UK music, it's like, come on, people. You gotta tell me these things. This is important.
Yeah, where is the newsletter for this particular fandom?
Exactly. Anyway.
I think you're gonna have to make that and subscribe to it, and then write all of the articles for it, because you'll be the only person reading them.
I'll do that after I do my aspect ratio show.
Okay.
Which is going to happen, by the way. Anyway, so, Bastille Day. Synopsis?
This is the episode with the Astral Queen, which is a prison ship with a really pretty name. And the prison ship has Tom Zarek and a bunch of other people who have been imprisoned. For some reason, they're moving them through space, because the prison they were at was not suitable.
No, they were on their way to parole hearings.
It's space, Con Air.
Yeah, whatever.
But the they essentially take control of the ship when Apollo and a bunch of other Battlestar Galactica crew people go to the ship to figure out what to do with the prisoners and give them the offer of essentially being water miners.
Yeah.
To get the water that they just discovered that's really difficult to acquire because water is hard to make good.
It's frozen.
Yeah, it's but so they need to melt impurities.
It. Well, but their big thing is they need to melt the ice in order to get it back up onto the ship.
Yeah, sure. It's a labored problem considering how much space technology they have, but they still need people on the ground to move water into boxes and package it and send it back up to space.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird. The point is that they go to the prison ship and Tom Zarek and some of his buddies take control of the ship, utilizing this particular opportunity and the presence of important people as hostages to get various demands met.
Yes.
Of course, it's another example of Tom Zarek being a revolutionary and a freedom fighter, but the episode also sort of like terminates with the realization that Apollo has, which is that Tom Zarek doesn't really expect to win, that he sort of just expects to be killed, and is sort of playing into the whole it's the end of the world narrative and not trying to survive.
Yes.
And the compromise that they come to at the end of it is essentially, we probably are screwed as a people. But, I mean, shouldn't we go out trying?
Mm-hmm.
And so Tom Zarek's like, all right, yeah, let's work together, sort of-ish.
Yeah. So, okay, just kind of like taking it back, I guess, to the beginning. One thing which I do kind of want to make note of, which is a minor thing, especially in BSG, but I think is kind of a big thing in terms of setting the tone for the types of stories that this show tells and the way that it tells those stories, is the fact that it's basically the continuity. You know, I mean, this is an episode where you could just pop it in and watch it on its own, get a complete story, and it would be completely satisfying. However, in the context of the whole, I think it's really cool the way that they sort of are building the mythology and painting a much larger picture with these smaller standalone episodes. I mean, you know, just before this was water, where they're desperately in need of finding water. Then they find the water and it's like, yay, we found the water. That's the end of that story. Then they're like, okay, we want to do a show about the prisoners and the rights of prisoners and this, you know, revolutionary and all this stuff. And in order to do that, we're going to set it against the backdrop of the episode that we just did. You know, we found the water, now we need to get the water. Okay, this is the story. So, like, when it starts up, it's almost like just a continuation and like a direct sequel. But the story that it's telling is a very different type of story, and one which is thematically not really related to the previous one at all. That's super cool. Like, that's the type of thing that I always wished things like Star Trek would be, you know?
I know what you mean. That's sort of one of the best things about season one, because I do actually see a very distinct discontinuation of that pattern. The show did sort of stop working like that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, when you get to, like, the last season and you've got, like, episodes like The Woman King and a couple of others stacked up one right after the other, it's like, what are you guys doing? Come on. Come on, guys. Try harder.
You know? Yeah. Season one is, like, the reason, like, I flipped out over the show so quickly was because season one was really, really incredibly good at all of the things. And really had no, like, I couldn't, like, point to a problem, aside from Ellentine. I couldn't really point to a problem with the show. Mm-hmm. And I was really into it. And after a big chunk of time, I, like, rewatched season one, and I was like, oh, this is better. It was better. What happened? and I was sort of sad. But like, I still stand by season one as being an impeccably clever series of stories that don't seem burdened by anything except, you know, the possibility of making each episode great on its own merits without being self-contained. Like, they were connected but not restrained by anything. It's sort of, you know, the perfect recipe, and it's still pretty exciting watching those early episodes.
Yeah, for me, it's weird because, I mean, seasons one and two, I don't know, there's nothing about them which, for me, like, really sort of defines them. Whereas in, like, seasons three and four, I can, like, point to specific storylines which were so epic that they really sort of became about that bigger thing as opposed to just individual episodes. And because of that, I mean, I do think that, like, seasons three and four are the best of the show. But I do enjoy seasons one and two, of course. And I don't really know which is better or worse, but I do remember getting through season one and thinking, like, of course this is amazing, but it feels like sort of a weak continuation of what was promised in the pilot. And then getting to season two and being like, okay, now they're back on track. Now I'm really sort of excited about this show in a way that I never really got in season one. But I couldn't tell you why. I'd have to go back and watch them again.
You see, I find that very weird. Because to me, season one is the best incarnation of the show's premise. Like, the whole end of the world narrative sort of dipped away towards the end of season one. They essentially stopped. It stopped being a show about the last people alive.
I guess that's true, but at the same time, there were some things that they did in season one where I was just like, guys, you're kind of going against. I mean, the fact that they had a storyline that took place on Caprica in season one after the apocalypse always seemed a little weird to me. And, like, a misstep.
You mean the what came to be known as Caprica Boomer?
I
still find that whole thread very strange, but its role in the larger show sort of redeemed it.
Yeah, they got lucky.
Yeah, but, like, I do actually, at the time, I did think, I don't know why we're watching so much of these two people hanging out, taking anti-radiation meds. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a weird, like, constant divergence into this bizarre little road movie. And I don't really know where it's going.
Right.
But aside from that, like, so much of season one is really on point to, like, the series as a whole. The idea of these people being right on the edge of extinction. Mm-hmm. And essentially always being just right there on that razor's edge, about to just be killed at any moment, and just barely eking by. And there's an aspect of that that's so dark that, like, obviously the show couldn't actually maintain, or people would just stop watching. Mm-hmm. It would just be too bleak.
See, I mean, I really think they did get back to that in the second half of season four after they leave real Earth.
Yeah, once that's the problem though. Like they finally admitted, like, oh yes, people are finally losing hope, which seems really late.
Yeah, maybe, but I mean, there were road stops along the way. I mean, there were, you know, there was New Caprica and stuff like that. I mean, that's a whole year where people essentially gain hope again.
Yeah,
we don't see it on screen, but
You know, but like it doesn't. There are aspects of the lifestyle of the colonials that seemed sort of oddly inhuman, and like basically how resilient they were, considering how quickly people lose hope in the real world. I mean, the stock market dips and people kill themselves. I mean, the idea that there aren't constant suicides, the idea that like people go to work every day for like 4 years and the same people are there day in, day out, and nobody just doesn't come into work because they killed themselves the previous night is sort of odd.
Yeah, yeah.
You would expect that, and that would actually be, I mean, if it was our world and that wasn't happening, we would need some sort of explanation.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. Yeah. Okay, so moving on, we've kind of talked about, you know, basically, okay, we've set this up and how they need labor for the water extraction, and they need like 1,000 people, and they're like, where are we going to get these 1,000 people? And they're like, oh, let's go to the prisoners. And you know, the president says, hey, well, I don't want to make them slaves. But then there is also this thing which, to me, you know, they throw out there, and I think like, that's interesting. And they're like, well, they were sentenced to, you know, x amount of years of hard labor, and this is hard labor, so we're justified in doing this. And then they're just like, yeah, they're not slaves. But like, how is this different from saying like, okay, you're filling your sentence or whatever, you know? I mean, to me they almost like muddied the issue by saying like, this is, you know, they're sentenced to hard labor. I don't know.
Well, because people will die.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, like, they make a point of how it's, like, not hard, but it's hard and dangerous work.
I guess that's true, yeah.
So it's not like, they're not saying, like, we're forcing these people to do labor. We're forcing these people to do labor that will kill probably a handful of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, like, at least one person's probably going to die. And, I mean, maybe 10.
Yeah.
It's not outside of the realm of possibility. It's probable that a few will be killed.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So then they come up with this point system, you know, to help earn their parole or whatever, which the only thing to me that seems weird, I mean, I guess when you're talking about, you know, the last 40,000 people and, you know, running away from Cylons and stuff, I mean, opportunities will arise, but I could only think of like prisoners being like, okay, so I got 5 points, and when are we going to start running out of food so that I can earn some more points? You know what I mean? I don't know, but whatever. I'm sure they could come up with things for them to do. So.
Yeah. there's always a question of, like, what happens when there's only 7 apples left?
Right, exactly.
And how useful is a prisoner at that point?
Yeah. So they propose this to the prisoners, and Tom Zarek, as the representative of the prisoners, is like, yeah, that's not going to work for us, you know, and we want this and this and this and this and this, and you know, if you're not going to give it to us, then we're going to go out in a blaze of glory, like Bonnie and Clyde
in space.
So let's talk about Apollo here, because he is sort of like the foil to Tom Zarek in this particular story. And he kind of sees the point that Zarek is making. And yet he's also representing not just the colonies, but the president herself. So
Yeah. And Galactica and his father. It's an odd... He's stuck between a whole bunch of different rocks and hard places.
Yeah. And I mean, his kind of like arc in this particular episode, I think, is pretty cool, because, you know, he's taking the initiative in a sense, you know, and he's sort of finding that middle ground between the president and Zarek, and saying like, hey, let's do what's right. You're both right. Let's do the right thing, you know?
Yeah, he essentially does a very Solomon-esque thing, and he basically screws over everyone equally.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who actually, you know, says we're going to hold elections.
Right.
And like way later they finally paid off that line. But like that was a pretty big deal, and after that, I know as an audience member, I was like, any day now they're gonna say something about elections, and every few weeks that went by and they didn't bring that up again, it got a little weirder.
Yeah, and my only real problem with this, I mean, it all works out in the end, but to me, the way that the episode was structured in terms of when we were given certain information sort of painted the individual scenes in a weird light. I mean, every time I watch this episode and there's the scene where he sticks the gun to Zarek's head and he's like, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you know, and then you're going to get your elections. And it's like, that scene, like the way that just plays is like, I don't know, kind of like the, you know, he's like throwing him a bone and saying like, oh yeah, you know, I really love you, kid, or something. You know what I'm saying?
No, not okay. At all.
All right.
You sound crazy.
I'm trying to think of an analogy, you know, almost like one of those scenes in movies where like someone is being like fake mad at someone, and then in Christmas Carol, you know, where he's like, what's wrong with you, you know, after he sees the error in his ways or whatever, you know, and he's like, I told you to report to work and blah blah blah, and Bob Cratchit is like, I'm sorry, you know, but Tiny Tim was having trouble and stuff like that, and he's like, you're gonna leave this house right now and go buy the best present you can possibly buy for your kids. And then Bob Cratchit is like, what? Oh, you're just, you know, busting my balls, Scrooge.
What version of Christmas Carol are you quoting?
Well, this is the original text.
This is the original text?
Yeah.
Buy the best gift you can get.
You
and Cratchit says, you just busted my balls. Scrooge. You're always such a weirdly comedic person.
See, you've been reading the American version your whole life, but if you go to the UK, I mean, like the version that Steve has, you know, that he reads to his kid, that's what I'm going off of. I found it when I was over in London last year. They had it in one of those.
They have it in the original drunk Irish text.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Not that slightly.
It played like that. Like, I'm sticking a gun to your head. You are gonna get these people back into their cells, and then you're gonna apologize for being an asshole, and then I'm gonna give you what you want.
No, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that there's a weird tone to Apollo's like final like nice thing that he says to Tom Zarek, that like actually, you know, validating his claims. It's sort of like saying, go to your room, you're not getting any supper today, but tomorrow I'm gonna totally get you ice cream, because
exactly.
I mean, you're pretty good, it's all good, you're all right.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it feels like.
So,
so there's that, but there's also the thing where, like, you know, the point that Zarek was making earlier in the episode, which to me always felt false, was he's like, why is Rosalind president? Who elected her? And it's like, well, the people did elect her. You know, I mean, they did elect her as the Secretary of Education, and the people did elect a Congress, which did you know,
well, they didn't ratify a. They didn't elect her. She was appointed.
But there is a way that society works, and there's a way that government works, and there is a contingency plan for this, you know. And the contingency plan is Laura Roslin becomes president. So yes, in a sense, the people did elect her because they elected all of the, you know, lawmakers who put these laws into place, which would eventually, you know, give her power. So when he's like, who elected her? Why is she president? It's like, she is legally president. This is not illegal. It is illegal to oust her from her presidency because she is legally the president, you know?
Sure, and it's unreasonable to assume that there would not be a president at this point, but it is unreasonable to assume that there would not be elections.
Right, but that wasn't the issue at first. You know, Zarek is like, there should be an election because she wasn't elected, and it's like, no, there shouldn't. You know, what Apollo says in the last scene where it's like, you're president until, you know, the Adar's term is up, which is in 7 months, and after that you gotta hold elections because that's the law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, the point that he's making there is good and fixes all the problems that I have with everything that everyone says earlier in the episode. The thing is, since we don't have that information up until that last scene, every time I watch the episode I'm like, well, no, Zarek? No, Zarek, you're wrong. And no, Lee, why are you promising this thing to him? Because that's your personal belief, but that doesn't have anything to do with the law or the way things are. And then it gets to the end where, you know, Roslin and Adama are saying that to Lee, and then Lee's like, no, guys, look, this is totally the way it is. I just told him that we were going to do, you know, what the law says, because we're going to do that, right? Right, guys? And then it's like, oh, burn, you know?
I don't know what you mean, but I just, that's, you're reading it strangely.
No. I mean, just the way that it's presented, it's like, it's good for that one scene, because it's like, oh, man, Rosalind, you got served.
No, what happened was that he said, we're going to hold elections.
Yeah.
That's not... He's not saying something that's very simple and straightforward. He's not just saying, we're going to follow the law. He's saying, like, your authority is temporary, and this scenario that we currently occupy that is incredibly tenuous, we are also going to continue obeying the law. And I know that that sounds crazy, because the idea of holding elections on a bunch of spaceships that are in constant motion... And there's only 40 or so thousand people alive. This is a crazy scenario in which to actually hold elections, but we're going to do that because that's the law. It's still nuts.
No, see, I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with that last scene. The problem that I have is the fact that that information, which is essentially revealed in the last scene, which, you know, establishes their process or whatever... paints a much more logical picture of the situation than all of the scenes prior. And since we don't get that information till the end, the other scenes kind of don't work for me while I'm watching them, because I'm like, what you're saying doesn't make any sense, you know?
See, I think what's happening is that you're giving more credit to that final scene. I don't think that actually justifies any of it.
Just
because the law supports the election does not mean that it's an even like rational thing to do. It's still crazy.
Maybe, but I mean, to me, you know, in terms of like the themes that the episode is dealing with, and you know, what is the rational thing to do versus what is the right thing to do, and using sort of the law as the basis for doing both of those things. I think it makes sort of perfect sense, you know, and they do find a middle ground there, which seems very logical to me. I mean, I am with Lee on that last scene. You know?
See, I think that like I'm with everyone in the last scene, and like I see Lee's compromise as being a completely rational compromise, but it's still crazy. Like, Tom Zarek's point of view that, you know, you have a democratic society for good or bad, for better or worse, the people decide what to do. you know, historically speaking, people often do very badly at that. When you're in a scenario like this, it is not unreasonable. It is, in fact, probably logical to assume that if you gave people the right to vote on their leaders, they would elect someone crazy, and then they would all be killed. Mm-hmm. And with Rosalind in power, if she is a benevolent fascist, she might actually be the best chance for survival. But mm-hmm. she's still a benevolent fascist, and that is, you know, politically unacceptable to some people. I know that I would find it politically unacceptable, but if I were in Lee's position, I would have a really hard time saying, let's hold elections to maybe replace her, because of the rights of the maybe. Ooh, that's a terrible idea. I would be really on the fence about all of those issues. So ultimately, Lee's compromise is kind of reckless. Mm-hmm. Like, the most sensible thing, like the rational decision, is actually the unacceptable, horrific one of killing everyone on the Astral Queen.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That would probably be the whole colony's, like, the entire fleet's best chance for survival would be to just blow it up. You know, just don't give them jump coordinates and leave them behind. You know, that would be the best chance for survival. Because, you know, Rosalind actually is reasonable. And she makes, like, incredibly hard choices. She decided to blow up the Olympic carrier, and that was a pretty dark thing that eventually they got around to admitting included a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
So, like, that's, to me, that last scene does not make it better. Like, it just sort of, like, explains the background behind the entire problem in a way that doesn't really make it okay. Just because it's the law doesn't mean it's smart.
I mean, I guess you're right. And, you know, that's sort of what makes this show so great, is the fact that we can have these discussions about what is right and what is wrong. And the show does not present any answers, you know? And
it does.
Well, sometimes it does. But by not presenting answers, it allows for discussion, which is ultimately, I think, much more valuable in terms of making its points, in a sense, you know, because it allows you to make the points for yourself.
Sure, that's a way of looking at it, and there are plenty of instances where the show does actually follow that particular logic, and there are plenty of points where it fails.
And I think this is one where it definitely succeeds.
I think it does as well, but I think that I don't know why you considered that thing a problem.
What I considered to be a problem, like I said, was not the scene at the end. It was the fact that we did not have the information that is revealed in that final scene earlier on in the episode.
Yeah, and my response is that I don't think that final scene gives any information that makes any of it better or worse. It's just, you know, procedural, really. I mean,
okay. Oh, fair enough. Okay, so now one last thing here. Let's just talk about sort of the raid and the Starbucks story on here. You know, you've got the whole thing where there's her and Ty butting heads.
Yes.
And, you know,
because Starbuck is the best pilot. Also sniper.
Yeah.
Also accountant.
Right. Yeah.
And her penmanship is better than anyone else on the ship.
And that's kind of lame to me. And, you know,
don't get me started on her boggle skills.
Part of the thing about this was, it's just like it dipped into that territory, which most of the time it was able to stay out of, where it was like, we have a cast of characters and we always need to have someone doing something. So in this scene, we're going to have this person who usually is in a cockpit fighting planes or whatever, on the ground, you know, with a sniper rifle,
yeah,
taking out prisoners, because I mean, what else is she gonna do? I mean, we wouldn't want to introduce a new character for that. where it's like normally they would introduce a new character and they'd have, you know, Starbuck, you know, just hanging back, you know, or whatever. And so that was a little disappointing to me. But I did like the whole raid on the Astral Queen. I thought that was kind of a cool thing? A little bit. Yeah, a cool sequence, a little action beat, you know.
Yeah, I do internal rationalizations for things like Starbuck's sniping skills and her usefulness in a squad level assault on a ship. Because I just sort of like think, okay, is there a reason why you would ever have that? And I think, oh, you know, she's like the ability to pilot a Viper is probably pretty unbelievably difficult. It's got to be a rather exceptional level of skills, and just to even get to that point, you've got to be really good at stuff. And I mean, the first level of skill would probably be, you know, essentially a grunt on the ground with a rifle. So I mean, if you get really good at that and you get promoted and you get, maybe, yeah, maybe that makes sense. Maybe the reason that she's a Viper pilot is because she was already really good at the other things lower down on the ladder. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I do that internal rationalization, and then, like, I get to the, you know, the point where they recruit a whole bunch of people to be Viper pilots, and I'm like, oh, that fall apart! Oh, no! No! And I get upset. But, I mean, like, at this point in the show, I was like, that logic holds.
Yeah.
That logic holds up.
And, I mean, it is a good little subplot that you have with you know, Ty and Starbuck, and their sort of confrontations and stuff. It's an interesting little beat in their relationship. But okay, one last note. Is this the last appearance of Boxy?
I don't think so.
He shows up later on?
I believe that he is in one of the later episodes. He's in, like, the Cobalt's Last Gleaming, I think he's in.
Okay. It's unfortunate that they had Boxy in here, because if they hadn't had Boxy in the show, then they could have named Hera Boxy. You live and learn.
This is the thing that you wanted to be?
Maybe Bryan Singer will do that in his new movie.
See, in my fantasy world, remake of Battlestar Galactica includes a lot of justifications for things. Like, I mean, like, I would solve the Starbuck is a good sniper and Viper pilot by, like, just making two different shows. There'd mm-hmm. be the action show, and there'd be, like, the Law and Order in space, and there'd be, like a SWAT team guy, and he would show up on a regular basis. He would be the best sniper.
Yeah.
That would be my way of handling the problem.
Oh, I guess one other thing that we should mention is they do the Cylon detector thing, and this is, like, the episode where he's like, what I really need is a nuclear warhead.
Yes.
But that's just sort of exposition more than anything else. So
it is. It's a funny scene, though. It's when they were still, like, unapologetically making Baltar hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good scene.
It's a really good, like, sustained thread of Baltar being the most fun character on the show.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, any final thoughts on Bastille Day?
I don't know why they called it Bastille Day. I mean, they're raiding a prison, and they're kind of redeeming the prisoners in a weird way. But, like, the presence of the word Bastille is so terrestrial. I still want, like, when I see that title, I think, I don't know why some of the titles are references to our reality, and some of the titles are references to their reality. Pick a point of view. Pick a position on the fourth wall and stay there. Titles of episodes.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, does it have to be? I mean, I don't know. I'm perfectly okay going back and forth between the two, you know?
I mean, I don't have, like, a problem. I just find it weird.
I mean, how?
It makes me think, how come there are no baguettes?
Like, Deep Space Nine has all sorts of weird titles, and yet, you know, probably the darkest episode of the show is titled after a line from Batman. Like, Tim Burton's Batman.
This is in the Pale Moonlight?
Yeah.
Oh.
Which, by the way, I was totally going to ask. I went to a thing a few months ago where Sam Hamm, the writer of Batman, was giving a talk after a screening of the movie, and I was like, I was going to be in the pale moonlight. The line is so awesome they even used it for an episode of Deep Space Nine. How'd you come up with that line? And then someone else did that, and then he's like, yeah, I didn't write that line. I did not like that subplot at all. I fought hard against it, and then we went on strike, and by the time I came back, that whole subplot was in there, including that line. So, sorry. And I'm like, oh, thank God I didn't ask him about that line. Anyway, that doesn't have much to do with Battlestar Galactica, but, you know, interesting story nonetheless, I guess. Whatever.
Is it?
I think so.
Oh.
So, any final thoughts on the episode itself, aside from the title?
I have a really weirdly conflicted feeling on the attempted rape scene.
Uh-huh.
I find that very, very, very dark. And I'm not entirely sure if that scene breaks the entire episode.
Uh-huh.
Because that, I mean, like, essentially, Lee is giving, you know, these guys a level of autonomy and a chance at freedom that they would not have had otherwise because of the scenario that they found themselves in. And that's rather odd, considering how dangerous and terrible some of these guys must be.
Yeah, but I wonder if, I mean, just the way that the stuff that they do with Zarek in there, I wonder, and maybe they should have had this in there to kind of balance that out, like a scene where Zarek is like, okay, you get back in your cell because, you know, you're making us all look bad, you know?
Yes. Come on, you're letting our side down, bro.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, don't be raping. I mean, come on. What's with the... Why do you gotta be always, like, the raping of things? I don't understand you.
See, if they would have done that, then... No, I'm just saying, like, if they would have done that, then there would have been this sort of, like, it would show, in a sense, that Zarek had a level of sophistication which would make you think maybe he can run this ship. Maybe they can be a productive part of society. And, you know, they will police themselves because things have changed and now they know what's at stake. But maybe you're right that as is, it's kind of weird.
So. Like, I don't have a problem with the presence. I have a problem with, like, the thought process that Lee must have had, like, minutes later.
Yeah.
Like, I guess we can work with these guys.
Yeah, no, that's true. All right, yeah, for me, on the whole, I do think it's a really good episode. I do like the way that it is a standalone story which fits into the larger whole in order to create a sort of big picture and add a lot of texture to this world. So, yeah, I mean, it's never an episode where I'm just like, oh, let me put on Bastille Day because this one's the bomb. But I do love sort of the way that it fits into the overall series. And also, I mean, hey, can you imagine being Richard Hatch and being like, oh, look at this. They're totally, you know, sort of trying to buy me off with this role. And, oh, maybe this is the best role I've ever had in my life, you know, and this is becoming a recurring, you know, role, which is going to last for, like, the next 4 years and going to be awesome. It's just kind of cool the way
I think that the whole scenario is kind of oddly great for everyone. Like, yeah. I mean, like, this isn't like an episode that I pop on to watch, but season one, it's sort of like when I watch the show, like, I'm excited about the next episode. Mm-hmm. At like every one, and yeah. Like when I start up this episode, I'm like, yeah, this is gonna be great. And I still think it is weird how good Richard Hatch is.
Yeah, he's really,
like,
good.
I mean, like, as a person, it's hard to imagine, like, joining a bunch of people who are essentially, like, overwriting something that was important to you and just making it so much better for them and yourself and being part of it. It's, I mean, he's a good man, you know? He's a big guy. He doesn't have, like, an ego problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's impressive. Cool.
Yep, it is. All right. So that was Bastille Day for you. We're glad that we could fill in on this show that we've been doing a lot more on, definitely. You know, we appreciate people like Steve and Xander and picking up the slack, and of course, Colin, who's, you know, essentially become, I think, like our showrunner. And
he's Adama.
Yeah, he's Adama.
I think I'm Boomer.
Which one?
The one that shoots Adama.
Okay. All right. That's cool.
So, just watch so you out. Know, Colin.
Yeah, watch out, Colin. All right. Then who am I? I guess I'm Boxy, right?
Well, I mean,
I showed up for like two episodes and then I went away without any explanation.
Is that how it's going to work?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
I think you should go for Gata.
I like Gata. He's cool.
You should work. You should try to be Gata.
Okay, cool. If you are looking for more of us, since we're never here, you can find us over on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we do Commentary Track Stars off topic with our friend Brandon, who hopefully we can get over here to talk about some stuff in the not too distant future. And you can also find us on Trek.fm, where we do Commentary Track Stars. And I also do Standard Orbit with Drew, who maybe we can get back over here to do some stuff in the not too distant future. We shall see. So that's it for this week. And next week, someone will be back to talk about some more BSG. In the meantime, what was our sign off going to be?
End of line?
Oh, yeah. So say we all.